Welcome to The Mountain Life. I'm Mary Beth Maziarz.
And I'm Lynn Ware Peak. Our guest this morning is author Jonathan Tepper. He is a Rhodes Scholar and author of several acclaimed financial books, who has published his first memoir. It's called Shooting Up, a memoir of love, loss, and addiction. It offers a deeply personal view of life at the intersection of faith, addiction, and resilience.
Although born in the U.S., Jonathan came of age in Madrid's San Blas neighborhood, a notorious place that would eventually be known as ground zero for Europe's heroin epidemic of the 80s. It was also the place where his missionary parents founded the country's first drug rehabilitation centers. His new book is an intimate portrait of radical compassion told through the eyes of a boy who witnessed miracles and tragedies in equal measure. Jonathan Tepper, welcome to the program.
Well, thank you very much for having me.
Well, let's start with talking about your unusual childhood. Did you realize at the time how out of the ordinary the way you were growing up was?
Not really, no. And in fact, I start the book with a quote from George Orwell, which he said, how natural it all seemed then, how remote and improbable now. And that came from his time in Spain, in homage to Catalonia. But I think when you're very young, you sort of assume the world is as you know it. You know, your parents and your little life is sort of all you know. And being essentially a missionary kid and going out and working with heroin addicts, which is what my parents were doing, seemed like, you know, a totally normal thing. It was only later in life, particularly like high school and then college, where I started realizing that most kids didn't have the same background I did and just how odd my childhood was.
For our listeners, maybe could you just offer a brief synopsis of what happens in the book?
Certainly. So my parents moved to Spain in 1983, and initially they wanted to work with university students, but they settled in a poor, very poor neighborhood because the rent was cheap and missionaries tend to be pretty poor. And they started helping the young men and women on the street, sending them to drug rehabs, trying to help the families. And then they realized the need was so great that they started their own drug rehab center with the help of a young Australian missionary. But the early addicts in the program became like older brothers and sisters to my brothers and me. There were four brothers. And almost all of the addicts in the early days shared needles and became HIV positive. So over the coming years, most of them, or almost all the early generation, developed AIDS and died. And the story, it really is a story of love and loss, of my own growing up from the age of seven till sort of the end of college, and my friendship and relationship with, particularly with Raul, the first addict in the program.
Jonathan, your parents would tell you boys, you and your brothers, to go out and find addicts to bring into the program. I think of the way I coddled my children and never have them go into anywhere that was dangerous at all. It's a whole different take on worldview. And I think that's what, you know, when we talk about in your book, there's just this radical compassion. It's a worldview. And your parents felt like you would be safe because you were these cute little blonde kids and no one would hurt you. Were you ever scared?
Not particularly going out like handing flyers to the addicts. They were much more interested in drugs or getting money to buy drugs than in, like, you know, wasting their time doing anything to little kids like us. One interviewer did ask me if my parents would have done the same thing if they had four girls instead of four boys, and I think they probably would have done it differently. But we were never, like, you know, too far away from our parents. You know, we might have wandered 50, 100, 200 feet away, but we were pretty close to where they were, you know, nearby. The time I do have it in the book, the time that I did certainly feel somewhat afraid or in danger was one of the early addicts. His name was Mahara, which is crazy. And he was a little crazy and fearless and tough, and he always had a knife and often a gun, but he used to just squeeze my hand until it hurt, and so I didn't like being around him on my own, and I didn't trust him very much. And then there was the first addict, Raul. I was always glad to be around him to protect me if Mahara was there.
Well, it does show that you developed sort of your spidey senses or your street smarts at a very early age, because you knew who you trusted and you knew who you didn't trust.
The addict, Raul, who you mentioned previously, you lost to AIDS.
How does that sense of loss permeate, I don't know, like your faith or your willingness to keep going out and recruiting new addicts for this rehab center?
So in the very early days, there was no center really, and my parents were taking addicts to other programs. And so we were handing out flyers, which had our phone number and our house address, and they'd come to like Friday night meetings, and then they'd come throughout the week. So they were always coming through the living room. And Lindsay McKenzie, the Australian missionary, nicknamed it Hotel Tepper, or sorry, Grand Central. My mother called it Hotel Tepper, but it was just always addicts coming in and out. And so in the early days, it was funding them. And then once the center started, it was a residential program. And my brothers and I often would spend, Friday or Saturday night out with the men. And then we'd go back home, after the church service. So they really were looking after us like older brothers. And so you got to become very close to them. And like the first addict who died in the program was Luis Mendoza. And I remember not being able to go see him in the hospital because my father thought, I was too young to go. And then the first addict, who is like an older brother to us, he died in 1995, and that was a tremendous blow. I went off to college in 1994 when I graduated from high school, and the peak in deaths in Spain was 94, 95, before the highly active antiretroviral therapy or heart therapy was introduced, which made AIDS and HIV be a treatable condition where obviously no one's cured, but people can continue to live with it, with a very low count. And so it wasn't just one friend dying, it was dozens and dozens of friends dying. And as I write in the epilogue, I think suffering itself is meaningless. It's our response to it that gives it meaning. And obviously, you can choose to harden your heart or become detached. And I think the response that my parents and the men and women in Battelle had, and the one that I've tried to have, is to simply have more love and more compassion for those who are hurting, and then try to treasure the memory of the friends who have gone.
Sure. Well, at that time, you would talk about how many people that were in your life that you lost. And AIDS was such a mystery. There was so much misinformation or lack of information at the time. Yet your parents were pretty unwavering in their willingness to be around people. And they turned out to be on the right side of history and that it wasn't a casual contact thing. But what do you think gave them that faith that you'd all be okay?
So when my parents first told me about AIDS, I think it was about 1985, and at that stage they knew how it was transmitted and how it wasn't. So it wasn't like it was 1981 or 82 where there's still some questions and the first cases were popping up. So at that stage, it really was a question of either being ignorant or knowing. And obviously there was quite a lot of irrational fear and ignorance. But my parents, knew that it came through, bodily fluids. We were too young to be having sex or anything like that, and then sharing needles, which we didn't do. But they were warning us not to pick up the needles in the neighborhood was the main thing that they were trying to, tell us. And of course, we, certainly wouldn't want to touch those. So we thought it was pretty pointless advice anyway. And I remember the incident very clearly because we thought we were being called into the living room to be punished for staying out too late playing soccer. It's like young little kids. In Spain, the way that people greet each other, particularly men and women, is a kiss on both cheeks. And so my parents always told us to hug people, to show them love, and to even show them even more love. And we wouldn't bring up the virus unless they wanted to talk about it, but we just treated them completely normal as if there was absolutely no difference. But at the time, many families didn't even want to visit their own children in the hospital, even though it was already known how it transmitted or didn't. And so I think it wasn't just the physical pain that they had, but also the social isolation that many people suffering from AIDS had.
Did you ever find as a child that you were resentful or envious of the attention that your parents gave to all these addicts in your community?
Yes, I think that it's something that many, if not most, I think preachers' kids and many missionary kids also feel. And I have a paragraph in the book where I talk about if your parents are doctors, lawyers, or engineers, it doesn't affect your life at all. But if you are a minister, You basically, and particularly a missionary kid, your parents' calling and mission essentially takes over your life. They decide to move to a foreign country, and you're along for the ride whether you want to or not. And then you're generally roped into whatever their mission is, trying to help others. And so, while it was fun and exciting, also there's like endless trips to drug rehabs or visits out to the farms or church services and things like that. And so you don't have the ability to really opt out. And then if an addict shows up on a Saturday night, my parents would take them out to a drug rehab. And so you're basically always the family time's always encroached. And then particularly late in high school, my father, mobile phones were invented, and so my father was always traveling and always on the phone with distant drug rehab centers. And I do remember like writing my essay for college application and being very upset at my father because he was like busy doing other things with the drug rehab center. And so some of that comes out in the book, but and it's not unreasonable, I think, for children to feel that way. But it's one that with time I realize that now that I am a father, I think parents certainly have many different things that compete for their time and attention.
If you're just joining us on The Mountain Life, we're having a conversation with author Jonathan Tepper. He has written a book. It's a memoir of love, loss, and addiction. It's called Shooting Up. It's about his childhood just outside of Madrid, Spain, along with his family, a missionary family. Jonathan, I'm wondering, if we grow up in sort of dodgy circumstances, as you did, we either become that, or we become the opposite of that. And I'm wondering, being so close to addiction, and for your brothers, we all respond differently to those circumstances. Did anyone go the way of addiction in your family, or were you ever tempted by, the allure of heroin or any of those things?
Yes, and I talk a bit about it in the book. I mean, fortunately, none of us ever tried heroin or did it. I think the main fear that I had was I knew people who had overdosed on heroin. Not to mention that obviously sharing needles, has its own problems. But yeah, it was of the it, it, it for me, it was a fear of death, and so I always had this sort of slightly childish and strange fascination with drugs. And honestly, if it made people feel so wonderful, the first time they tried it, what did that feel like? And I always asked addicts how much heroin cost and where you'd buy it and how you prepare it and things like that. But I never did anything myself, my brothers either. My parents were pretty strict, and we spent quite a lot, almost all of our time sort of focused on either studies or helping out in the drug rehab center. And I think a lot of the like your success or not in life really does come down to the people around you and like your parents. And my parents certainly looked after us and cared for us. And I think that a lot of the reason why so many in the neighborhood ended up becoming addicts was that at the time the youth unemployment rate in Spain was very, very high. Families had quite a lot of kids, and so they had tons of free time out in the streets with their friends. And after Franco's death, a lot of drugs came in. And so, it's while willpower and sort of, pulling yourself up by your bootstraps, obviously matters in some cases. In general, there are much stronger forces at play. And, people don't pick their starting point in life in terms of who their family are or even what neighborhood they grow up in.
Absolutely. Well, you now are a chief investment officer. You've been an executive. You've written books on capitalism. You're in a very different world than you were as a child. And I'm wondering how it informs your professional life, just the fact that you were raised in these circumstances, and compassion and showing love and more love to people is a way to go through life, and it's healing and seems like a panacea, at least the way you talk about it in your book. So, how do you approach your professional life with that in mind?
So, personally, I've tried to volunteer time and money to organizations that I care about, particularly my parents' organization, and then education, particularly for kids who have come out of the world where their parents were addicts. I've also been on the board of directors for Battelle of Britain, the drug center in about 20 countries. But the broader question about sort of how you want to live your life, I think, is one that people have to ask themselves, whether they're working in financial markets and doing well financially, or in more menial jobs. You can be a absolutely miserable, greedy, poor person, or you can be a miserable, greedy, rich person. And how you decide to live your life is one that all of us have to decide. And I know some very, very wealthy, even billionaires who are pretty miserable. And I know others who are very humble and give an enormous amount of money away and are just absolutely wonderful people. So it really, I think, does come down to how you want to live your life.
It really does. Well, lest our listeners think that this is merely a harrowing tale, they should know there are some very funny moments. You describe some glass eyes popping out, and could you share a couple of just the absurdities that you witnessed or stories that looking back are kind of wild and crazy that these junkies, these yonkies, they're of their experiences as they share them with you?
There's one I put in the book, which I remember very well, and people seem to love. And in the early days, the addicts would just all flock to the church service on Sunday morning, because often, like, they were just waiting to get into the program. There was, a shortage of beds, and it was growing quickly. And sometimes it was a fairly informal. My parents were sort of non-denominational evangelicals, but or say they were Presbyterians, but the church itself was run essentially open to anyone. And the addicts would sometimes get up and pray. And so you had addicts who still, like, didn't know almost anything about the gospel, getting up and praying. And one a hippie got up and prayed and thanked God that the police did not catch him as he was stealing all the money from the slot machines the night before. And so Raul, the first addict in the program, was like, "Well, we're gonna have to go over the Ten Commandments again. Thou shalt not steal." Often they would pickpocket the men and women. Like, they'd steal the money from the women's purses during the church service because they put them under the seats, or they would hug the men after the services and take their wallets. Just a lot of, like, crazy, crazy things. And then the addicts themselves were wild. So going out and having dinner with them, they were always teasing each other endlessly. Like, Manuel Vasco had a glass eyeball that would fall out during football games, or even he'd sit on the subway and one eye would shut and the other would stay awake, sort of scaring the other passengers.
I also like the story. I think it's Jambri who survived a post-robbery shootout because the getaway car he stole happened to be a bulletproof vehicle of a politician.
It was totally crazy. And he was a painter when he was not robbing banks. And he used to come by, and I worked with the painting team in Battelle. And like, in my high school years, I remember he would just come by and try to correct me on my painting jobs. It was a very funny, interesting group of people who are definitely larger than life.
I thought some of those were really terrific. How have you found, we were, Lynn brought up at the beginning about how your parents' approach and gift of independence to you kids when you were growing up was very different from the helicopter style we see a lot right now. How do you think, you have a little one, right? How is that
I
affecting the way
do.
you're parenting?
So my son is two, and he's already extremely independent minded, where I can't, and I only speak to him in Spanish. And my wife's American, and but because I grew up in Spain, I want him to be bilingual. So I only speak to him in Spanish, and I ask him, like, if he wants help, and the answer is always no. Like, he's going to figure out how he's going to do it on his own. And sometimes I know he's going to hurt himself. And as long as he's not going to, like, scar himself or maim himself badly, I'll let him do it, because he's a pretty quick learner, and, like, he won't hurt himself twice. And surprisingly, he actually figures out how almost everything works. And I think that a lot of education, in my view, is sort of trying to constrain curiosity or tell kids that they can't do things. I would prefer to have him try to figure the world out. And eventually, obviously, I mean, it's not like he's undisciplined, but eventually there's, time for more structured learning. But the more he can try to do on his own, the better, I think.
Yeah, that is great and wonderful that you speak to him only in Spanish.
Yeah, he
That's
walks up to strangers and starts speaking to them in Spanish. And
great.
there's really not everyone does. So.
Yeah, and is he a little blonde-haired boy too?
Yeah, and he looks just like my younger brother Timothy when he was his age.
Yeah. Wow. This book, you say that you avoided it for a long time, and then it finally got to this point where it was unavoidable. And I'm wondering if it's anything about the time that we live in now. not tolerating, immigrants and other people were it's a time of deep divides. Is it something about the time we live in now that made you write the book?
So I started writing the book, I think very late 04 to early 2008. I was writing it like evenings and weekends while I was working at a hedge fund in New York. And I sent it around and it got quite a few rejections. And then I just thought, you know what, I'm very busy and I was starting another business and life just took over and I've been a fund manager. But I was having lunch with a mentor of mine, and he had found a lot of letters between his parents, and it sort of brought back a flood of memories. And we were chatting about my own father, who is 78, and I mean now he's 79. And he said, "You really should get this published before your father passes." And I just thought, I shouldn't let it sit in a drawer. It's a beautiful story, and rejections are part of life. And if you look at like J.K. Rowling was rejected everywhere. I mean, Elie Wiesel's Night was rejected 15 times before André Malraux, the Nobel Prize winner, asked his publisher to publish it. So like the fact that something's rejected is not a statement of the inherent worth of the book. And so I just thought, you know what, I'll edit it further and get it published. And sure enough, thank God, now it is coming out next week. But so that was like, in a way, the motivation was to actually have it, let it be published when my father's alive. But to your point, and I do agree, part of the reason I'm glad it's coming out now, and I write about it explicitly in the epilogue, I think that a lot of Christians in particular, and obviously that's sort of the world that my parents were part of, I think are often now think it's important to be involved in the culture wars or to have political influence. And there's this movement sort of dominionism, which is like having sort of dominion of like the political sphere among others. The example my parents lived, and my father and mother basically showed love and compassion, one addict at a time for over 40 years and changed the lives of hundreds of thousands of people. And I think that to me is much more in line with the teachings that one would find in the gospel and the Sermon on the Mount. I think this sort of very binary thinking that, either you're on our team or you're not, has absolutely nothing to do with the love that one finds in the gospel. And if you look at Jesus, he spent time with the lepers, who obviously were social outcasts. The Samaritans were also social outcasts. Women who had been accused of adultery. Roman soldiers were widely hated by the Jews at the time. And tax collectors, obviously very unloved people. And these were all the people that appear essentially in throughout the New Testament. And so that in part as well was one reason I wanted to write this. And it's not a book that preaches. I think the key rule of writing is show, don't tell. And I think the story of my parents sort of shows.
Yeah, it was interesting as I was reading in the book. I kept wondering how you practice faith now. And it's not really uncovered to the reader as you're reading through, which is really nice because then it's this universe gives a universal appeal to people of faith and people who may not adhere to a certain theology.
Yeah, and I did not want to write a Christian story, and I've said this to Christians who've read it and loved it. And part of the reason is that if I and I know because I grew up in a Christian home with a lot of Christian books read to me, if it were a Christian book, it would only appear in Christian bookstores and it would be read by Christians. And the other problem I have with Christian books in general is that they are written to teach or to preach. They're almost never written as great literature. It's not to say that there aren't some great Christian books from a literary standpoint. But I think that this story is a universal story of love and loss, and you don't have to believe anything at all to appreciate the profound love and sort of family and friends that's there. And friends of mine who are Jewish, Muslim, and Hindu have absolutely loved the book. And people I know who are Christian find their faith renewed. So it's not one that tells the reader they need to believe anything.
You mentioned your father. Is your mom still alive?
So my mother died in 2012, but she was working with my father up until the very end. And then my father is still alive. He had a minor stroke last year, which he's recovered from terrifically well. But I think he has told us he wants to work until the day he dies, trying to help others.
That sounds like him, based on the way he's described in the book. What does he think of the book? Do his memories of this period align with yours, or does he have a different way of remembering him?
Yeah, so he half jokingly says that I was too hard on him in the book, and I pointed out that I could have included other things, but and that conversation usually ends. But he does think that I told the story as it was, sort of from the inside. Whereas, you know, some journalists have written articles over the years about Patel, and they're generally fairly superficial or even misunderstand what's going on because you show up for half a day and look at what's going on and then leave. You know, I grew up in the drug rehab center effectively with the men and women as older brothers and saw it before it even existed when I was handing out flyers. So he thinks I've told the story as it was and also gotten sort of the deeper truth of the love and compassion, you know, that's there. I think everyone would write a different story if my father wrote it or my brothers wrote it. They have their own memories that are important to them or angles that they would want to write. And so certainly if he wrote it, it would be a different book. But he absolutely loves the book.
Yeah, the gospel according to the Teppers.
Yeah.
You could all have your own chapters.
Yeah.
We have been speaking with author Jonathan Tepper, whose new book, Shooting Up, A Memoir of Love, Loss, and Addiction, is just coming out. What is, if there's one theme or idea that you'd really like people to leave with having read your book, what would it be?
I would say that to those who are hurting and suffering, that you're not alone. And I think that the answer to suffering is more love. And that's the example that my parents gave. And I hope the book connects with people. And they, even though that's it's a unique story, it's one that they can identify. You know, everyone has friends and everyone has family that they love.
Thank you so much for being with us on the program.
Well, thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
That's a beautiful book.
Thank you.
Thanks. Really beautiful.
Thank you very much. It's an absolute pleasure chatting with you. I really enjoyed it.